Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for February 19th, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, predicting human mobility patterns, a possible mechanism of prebiotic sugar formation, and the winners of the 2009 Science and Engineering Visualization Challenge. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about the God spot in the brain, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
In modeling the spread of a contagious disease, such as novel H1N1 influenza, researchers used information from airlines to figure out how the disease was likely to spread from country to country and from city to city. Now researchers are looking at data from mobile phone companies to help model the spread of such diseases, refine traffic patterns, and address other mobility questions on a neighborhood-by-neighborhood basis. In a paper in this week's Science, Laszlo Barabasi and colleagues report that level of predictive detail is possible because our movements are up to 93% predictable, despite considerable differences in our travel patterns, age, gender, and where we live. I spoke with Barabasi from his office at Northeastern University in Massachusetts.
Human mobility is really at the basis of how the society works. You know, in order to meet people, we have to move. In order to work, we have to move. In order to, you know, have fun, we have to move. So it is really, you know, our ability to get from point A to B and, you know, our regularity when we do so is crucial for a number of applications. For example, when it comes to spread of diseases or influenza, it really depends on our ability to go to places where there is an influenza virus or others to come to us with the virus infected. When it comes to city planning, it's crucial to understand where people go on a daily basis, and it's crucial to understand how regular they are. That is, how predictable is their daily motion. When it comes to traffic patterns, for example, if you want to design a better city, it's crucial to understand how regularly people move from point A to point B, but how much are the fluctuations, how much they deviate from that pattern, because that really determines the traffic on the roads that you build and, the, you know, kind of developing in the city where people live. So there are a number of applications that rely on our ability to understand human motion, on our ability to understand where you are now, where you're going to be in the evening, and where you will be tomorrow at 3 p.m. So we are far more predictable than we actually think about ourselves. We have a regular schedule on a daily basis, and we assume that despite of our regularity, there are people out there who are far less regular, who are kind of going crazy, and they are very spontaneous. What we are finding is that when we look at our mobility and our movement on a daily basis, there aren't those spontaneous people out there. Each of us are very regular, and that regularity makes us very predictable.
So what is the limit of predictability in a person's mobility?
What we find is that people have about a 93% predictability. What does that mean? It means that if somebody has access to your previous mobility pattern, where you were yesterday, the day before, and so on, let's say on an hourly basis, then in principle could build a program that could predict your future locations with as much as 93% accuracy, which means that it will make mistakes about 7% of the time.
And where does this data come from for mapping or finding out a person's mobility?
One of the best mobility data is really coming these days from mobile phone companies. Because every time we use our mobile phone, the companies are required by law to record our location for billing purposes. They need to know where you were and whom you called, because that essentially appears on your phone bill. Now, phone companies collect this data routinely, and in most countries, particularly in Europe, they are required by law to do so. And what they do is that they de-anonymize it, which means that they remove all the individual identifiers. So we don't know names, we don't know phone numbers, and they provide subsets of this data set available for researchers for study. Because even for phone companies and for lots of applications, it's important to understand the behavior of their consumers. So our data comes from a mobile phone company. It's completely de-identified. All we know is essentially a little particle that move in space. And we analyze kind of the regularity and the behavior of these particles. They are like particles in a gas bouncing into each other.
Were people using their phones all the time? Or did you have to extrapolate to fill in the times when people weren't using their phones about where they were?
The real challenge is that phone companies do not record all the time the location of the individuals only when they make a phone call, because that's when they have to bill them. So some people make lots of calls. Other people make very seldom calls. Sometimes a person uses the phone very frequently, an hour or two, and they may go another day when he or she never picks up the phone. So the record that we have about individuals is very uneven in time. So one of the challenge research-wise was for us to nevertheless measure predictability using this incomplete data. Now, if you are completely regular, that is that you always go at 8 o'clock to work, come home at 5 o'clock, and you stay home always, and you never change that pattern, even if I have an incomplete record of your trajectory, I can interpolate from you your regularity, because I will see that there is no deviation ever from this pattern. Every time you make a phone call, you are where you are expected to be at that time. Given that people are relatively regular, we were able to extract not their trajectory from this pattern, but a measure that we call predictability. That is, we were able to measure how often they deviate from their normal pattern, and that allowed us to measure essentially, or kind of to calculate for each individual, how much is their predictability.
So I can imagine that many people who have cell phones divide their time, as you say, perhaps between work and home, at least during the week. How did that predictability change on the weekend?
Surprisingly, we expected that people may be very regular during the week because the kind of the work schedule imposes on them some regularity, but they should go really spontaneous over the weekend. What we find is not really the case. People who are terribly regular during the week, they are just as regular on the weekend. That is, they do, of course, different things. They don't go to work, but their predictability is just as high during the weekend as it is during the week. So we don't find a significant difference between the weekend and week patterns.
Any differences in people who travel a lot compared to those who don't?
That was a real surprise. So the data indicated that, as not unexpected, that most people travel very little on a daily basis. You know, they really move into, you know, 1 to 3 mile distance from their home. A few individuals, however, travel very, very long distances on a daily basis, hundreds of miles. So we kind of said, well, perhaps the people who are very homebound, they would be very predictable. But these, you know, globetrotters, the people who travel long distances, would be very, very hard to predict. To our surprise, this was not the case. The people who travel a lot, their predictability was truly comparable to people who travel very little, roughly the same, and relatively to how many different locations they could travel given their big distance that they cover, they were more regular than the people who kind of stayed around home. And one way to understand that is that if your distance between home and work is, let's say, half a mile, you know, you have lots of time to do other things. If you have to drive an hour and a half to work and back, you know, 3 hours of your day essentially are taken away. So you have very little freedom to be spontaneous, to do new things, because you're working, then you're traveling home, and you're pretty much crashing and preparing for the next day. So this was a surprise to us. We expected to be significant differences depending on the distance, but we're not finding that.
What about other demographic factors like gender, age, or where people live?
Gender-wise, we did find a bit of a difference. It appeared that women show a slightly more predictability than men, about 6% more. I need to add that it's statistically not significant. So even though we see systematically that difference, it's not a big enough difference to really tout it as a big news. Regarding age, we're not seeing big differences in that respect. It's relatively flat regarding the age. We don't have access to other demographic factors. I mean, you know, we looked at whether rural and, you know, metropolitan or small city environments. We couldn't see much of a difference there. So in general, one of the reasons the result was so surprising is that it was so insensitive to the demographic characteristics we had. It seems to be something innate to how we are and how we like to behave. Over the weekend or during the week, young or old, female or male, we all display a very high degree of predictability.
What then is the lower limit? If the upper limit is 93%, what's the lower limit? And so the range of how predictable people's movements are.
So we truly expected that there would be people out there who would be pretty much impossible to predict, you know, and you can make some guesses, you know, people who drive trucks and, you know, salesmen and so on. Surprisingly, we are not seeing them in the database. Is that a limitation of the data? Do these people don't use cell phones? I doubt that. So what we are finding is that kind of at the lower end of predictability lays around 80%, which means that, you know, we'll be missing their future location about 20%, and 80% of the time we could actually predict their whereabouts. So what is one of the surprising results of the study is the lack of these very low predictability individuals.
So what implications, then, does your team's work have for the work of others? You mentioned modeling epidemics like influenza, city planning, traffic engineering. Is this a basis for them?
I believe so, because what our study shows is that there is a high degree of regularity and predictability in our mobility, which gives the basis, the fundamentals for building large-scale models for, let's say, influenza prediction. Let me give an example. Right now, there are very good models to predict how the H1N1 spreads from city to city, which means that these models can tell you, and they did tell us rather precisely, that perhaps tomorrow there would be 200 H1N1 cases in New York City. However, they would not tell you whether Harlem would be more affected, or it would be the Bronx, or it would be Manhattan that would be more affected by it. In principle, the regularity of the individuals allow us to bring these models down to the city level. And the reason why these models are not at the city level is that currently they use only the airline data, how people fly long distances. They don't use how people move around the city. So given the high regularity of the individuals and given the data availability from mobile phones, in principle, we could imagine the future in which your mobile phone will tell you that if you go in that neighborhood tomorrow, then you will have an elevated chance of getting a particular virus.
Sounds like there might be some serious privacy concerns here.
Well, absolutely, but that's exactly the challenge that we all have as scientists, is to show the potential and the problems in these tools and let the society decide whether we can afford to have these systems and whether it's worthwhile the privacy concerns to develop some of these technologies. What our data suggests, and you know that's why we always go out and publish this publicly, is to show people this is possible. Now it's up to us to decide, do we want it?
Laszlo Barabasi, thank you very much.
Sure, thanks a lot.
Laszlo Barabasi of Northeastern University is senior author of a paper on the limits of predictability in human mobility. More than a century ago, Russian chemist Alexander Butlerov discovered how to get formaldehyde to spontaneously react to form simple sugars such as ribose and glucose, a process known as the Formos reaction. Sugars are needed for any theory on the prebiotic origin of life because RNA and DNA couldn't form without them. But the problem with the Formos reaction as a prebiotic process for the origin of life is that it produces unstable sugars that degrade in just moments. Now, in a paper in this week's Science, Joseph Lambert and colleagues report the production of stable forms of biologically important sugars from the Formos reaction by adding silicate. And because silicate is so common on Earth, the Moon, and even in asteroids, the team suggests that these Formos-like reactions may provide a feasible pathway for the prebiotic formation of the sugars needed for the origin of life. I spoke with Lambert from his office at Northwestern University in Illinois.
I've tried to explain how sugars might have come about at the beginning of the chemical phenomenon that we like to call the abiotic creation of life. The abiotic means that there was no DNA, there were no biological processes, but somehow or other the molecules that are going to constitute life had to come about. And they had to come about in a very thermodynamically, that is to say, spontaneous fashion. And we have provided at least one possible way that sugars can have come about. There are other types of molecules, amino acids, and we're not talking about them.
Now, scientists have been studying this problem for quite some time, and there's this classic Formos reaction. Could you tell us briefly what this Formos reaction is?
Well, there was a great Russian chemist named Butlerov, and sometime around 1850, he discovered that he could take very small molecules and turn them into decent-sized carbohydrates, which are the alternative name for sugars. and the sugars are being formed out of molecules that have one carbon. Those include formaldehyde, formic acid, things of that sort. Formaldehyde is the smallest possible sugar-like molecule. It has one carbon. He found out how to turn it into the 5 and 6 carbon molecules, which are the molecules of life. And it was an existing process for 100 years before, around 1950, several chemists decided that this could have been a process whereby the sugars were formed in the prebiotic, the pre-life situation of Earth. And it was a great idea, and people embraced it very quickly. And then, as so often happens in science, became disillusioned as the foremost reaction was very complicated. It was indeed spontaneous, a room temperature or close, which would make it a good candidate, but it just made a terrible mixture of all the possible sugars that you could imagine. And furthermore, they were all unstable, and so you got this mixture. And so by the year 2000, people were becoming disaffected by it, and there was really no favored mechanism to replace it.
How had researchers previously tried to overcome the limitations of this classic foremost reaction?
Well, the main focus was to try to become selective. And, of course, ribose would be one of the focus molecules because it's the sugar that is present in DNA and RNA. Glucose might have been because it's the sugar that's present in so many of the sugars of life also. But ribose is present in 1% or less of the products of the foremost reaction. Glucose is also a very small amount. So what many chemists tried to do was to find ways whereby they could enhance that. And there have been several reasonably successful ways of doing that. That does not meet the problem of the fact that ribose and glucose both are still unstable, so even a higher percentage, given enough time, they would decompose. So the objective was to move the percentage up from the sub 1% to a more significant amount.
And what prompted you and your team to add sodium silicate to this mix of these simple sugar molecules to overcome that?
Well, from my point of view, the silicon came first. For the last 25 years, I've been an organosilicon chemist, that is to say, an organic chemist who focuses on how silicon can be used in organic reactions. And that evolved our interest towards silicate. And we were piqued by a publication, in fact, in Science in 1999, of a study that had found that sodium silicate, which is just the same sort of thing that is present in sand, but under basic conditions, you might call it solubilized sand, that sodium silicate could react with molecules containing multiple hydroxy groups. And what we thought was there is no more important group of molecules that contain multiple hydroxies than the sugars. And this particular study had not looked at the sugars. It looked at mostly polyhydroxy compounds without other functionalities. And so in the early 2000s, we started looking at the reactions in sugars. Now, this is what we call the top-down approach, because what we did was we took the fully formed sugars and found that they reacted with sodium silicate to form a stable complex. And it was only later, another 5 years, sometimes thought is very slow, another 5 years before we thought, well, if these things are being stabilized, what if we tried to synthesize them? Would they be stabilized in the prebiotic sense? And so we turned the reaction upside down, and instead of starting with the big molecules, glucose, ribose, we started with the small molecules, knowing that the foremost reaction under basic conditions would start building them up to see if once they've been formed, they would be trapped out. And this is basically what our report in Science is that is what happens.
And how stable are these products, these simple sugars, after reacting with silicate?
We found that the 6-carbon sugars that are formed are stable instead of for seconds, they're stable for hours. And we didn't study them for longer than a timescale of days, but this is a contrast to the standard foremost reaction in which within several minutes, a simple reaction product mixture becomes a very complex product mixture. So we illustrate in the Science article how the product mixture when 6-carbon atom sugars are formed is essentially stable for hours to days. We found that we could make the 4-carbon sugars, and they were somewhat less stable. We also did the 3-carbons, which are a little more difficult because of the fact you have to assemble the odd-membered ones with a combination of even and odd small molecules, whereas the even numbers you could just double so that you could take a C2 and make a C4, you could take a C3 and make a C6. But to make the C5, you have to have C2 and C3 present both, then you can make the C5. So already you're starting to get complexity. But for the even-numbered molecules, such as the C6s, of which glucose is an example, they are, we won't say indefinitely stable, but they are stable for quite long term at room temperature.
So if I may summarize, with the products then of the classic Formose reaction, the idea is that in an early Earth, the Formose reaction occurred, and then because there was silicate around, that in turn may have led to stable forms of more complex sugars needed for the origin of life.
That is correct. And if you want to build the whole thing up, you only need a small amount. This is the Breslau mechanism. A small amount of the C2 to get the whole machine going, because of the fact that once you added a formaldehyde or two formaldehydes, because of the instability of these things, they fall back apart to the C2s and C3s, so that the formaldehyde can't start the reaction, but it can feed the reaction. And so the carbons can ultimately come from the one carbons. And what we showed in the science paper is that not till they get to C4 do they react with sodium silicate and are stabilized. So it can build up C2, C3, and these in turn must go up to the, either the C2 can double to the C4, the C3 can double to the C6, or they can cross-react to the C5. And those first formed higher molecules are the stable ones. And the reason why a silicate has to form a five-membered ring, the smaller rings are unstable, and you can't, just by counting the carbon atoms and the oxygen atoms required to form the ring, you can't form the five-membered ring till you have a four-carbon molecule. So glyceraldehyde, which is the C3, will not react, but it's one of the early products of the Formose reaction. So you have a machine whereby formaldehyde can feed to the C2 and the C3, forming the C4 through 6, and as they are formed, they are, you might say, sequestered by sodium silicate spontaneously and instantly.
How about the handedness, the chirality of the sugars that are products of your team's reaction with silicate? Are they all the same handedness, like the sugars found in RNA and DNA?
They are racemic. Racemic meaning equal amounts of the two hands. And formaldehyde itself is planar and cannot have handedness. As soon as you get the higher molecules, the C3 is the first one that can have handedness. But we start with the racemic glyceraldehyde, meaning equal amounts. And so we go up to the racemic C4, 5, and 6. The question is, how could you have handedness created out of these equal amounts of the C3, for example? And the suggestion has been made, and this is the one that we're trying to follow up, is that you have to have some sort of handed catalyst, term is chiral catalyst. And what we're using there are chiral clays, which are aluminosilicates. And we're trying to make the Formose reaction go in the presence of clay. And we hope that if we do the reaction in the presence of chiral clays, that is to say clay with handedness, we would then be creating molecules that have handedness. And so then you could start worrying about always backing it up a step. We can get handed sugars from handed clays. So where did the handed clays come? And we'll turn that over to the geologist.
Okay. Joseph Lambert, thank you very much.
Okay, and thanks for doing the interview.
Joseph Lambert of Northwestern University is lead author of a paper on the silicate-mediated Formose reaction, the bottom-up synthesis of sugar silicates. Picture for a moment what the double helix of DNA looks like. Now try picturing the Vitruvian Man, in which Da Vinci shows the proportions of a man circumscribed inside a square and, at the same time, inside a circle. These science illustrations go well beyond any words that could describe them, and to celebrate this tradition of visualizing science, engineering, and technology, Science Magazine and the National Science Foundation hold a competition each year called the International Science and Engineering Visualization Challenge. And this week, you can see the winning entries for the 2009 competition in the magazine and online. Science's Lauren Schenkman spoke with one of the competition's judges, as well as the two winners who created the magazine's cover image, and she filed this report.
Science visualizations help scientists see and understand what's invisible to the naked eye, whether painted with a brush, pictured through a microscope, or programmed with a computer.
And then it ends up being, you know, something that's beautiful or stunning or informative.
Thomas Lucas helped judge this year's visualization challenge. A producer and writer, Lucas says a lot of science visualizations involve high-tech graphics and simulations.
So we see a lot of that in this competition, and that's very interesting. But we're always reminded of the low-tech very clever, very creative approaches that come out of the minds of people who are submitting these entries.
One of the winning entries started out high-tech with a computer simulation of how cells push and pull on each other as they form capillaries in the lung. But when architect Jenny Sabin considered what it would cost to build a room-sized, tangible version of what the simulation was showing, she settled on a decidedly low-tech building material, ready-made, inexpensive zip ties.
You know, everybody knows what a zip tie is, and they all have different associations with cable zip ties.
Like for construction, or for organizing the wires behind your stereo, or even as temporary handcuffs. But in the sculpture, Sabin says each of the 75,000 zip ties represents a data point.
And so what you're looking at is the transformation of a force network that is exerted by those networking cells upon their matrix environment.
In other words, when you see the sculpture, you're not looking at lung cells, but at the forces those cells exert. The sculpture maps out the invisible mathematical quantities with zip ties that you can see and touch. But even if you don't understand what the sculpture means, biologist Peter Jones says that's okay. Jones collaborated with Sabin on the winning entry and says the power of the visualization is in seeing it, walking through it, even playing on it.
I think the sheer intensity of the piece does provoke people to ask what they're walking through. You know, multiple levels. Of course, kids love it. You know, this is science. Wow, you can climb through it and you can see shadows through it and you can run around it and get these weird effects as you use it as a maze. I mean, even at that scale, I think it's very important and provocative.
But Sabin and Jones didn't intend for their sculpture to merely entertain or provoke questions. Instead, Jones says, they wanted a way for scientists to interact with tens of thousands of data points all at once.
To start to think of, as we enter this era of massive data sets, can we really see what's going on using conventional means? And we believe that isn't going to be possible. And sort of probing the limits of how one can see, feel, or hear may allow us to see what is now unseeable, providing us with new clues as to how these systems operate.
And it's that highly unusual approach that really caught the judges' attention. Again, Thomas Lucas, one of the judges of the competition.
What drew me and some of the other judges to this visualization, this really is a sculpture, was the fact that you could walk into it and the choices that the creators made are not intuitive. They used a lot of twist ties to put this together. And I'm not sure how they came up with that, but it's a very visually dynamic environment that they created. So you can walk into this, and the impression is so strong that you're going to learn something. You're going to get some kind of knowledge out of it.
And that's really the point of a science visualization. And it's even better when that visualization has something for nearly everyone who looks at it. Again, architect Jenny Sabin.
It's equally relevant for the scientist or the artist or the designer in the sense that they're able to see anew what they weren't before. So we're very, very interested in accessibility and providing new venues for diverse audiences to look at intersections between science, art, and design, because too often the fields are separated.
You can find Sabin and Jones's winning entry on the cover of this week's magazine. For the Science Magazine podcast, I'm Lauren Shankman.
Science's Lauren Shankman on the International Science and Engineering Visualization Challenge. You can find the winners for the 2009 competition in this week's Science and online at www.sciencemag.org/special/VIS2009. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about the God spot in the brain. What region of the brain are we talking about here, Dave?
Rob, we're talking about the posterior parietal brain region, which is this region sort of in the upper back of the brain.
And why is it called the God spot?
Well, it's actually not called the God spot. It's a little bit misleading. Researchers have been looking for years for something that they've been calling the God spot. And what they mean by that is some region of the brain responsible for our spirituality. In other words, is there a part of the brain that makes us religious or makes us believe in spiritual or transcendent experiences? And researchers have done things like brain scans and MRIs, and these have all come to very conflicting results. And the bottom line is nobody's really isolated a part of the brain that they can call the God spot.
I imagine it would be difficult to experiment on people removing parts of the brain to look for it.
Exactly. But that's what makes this new study unique, is that they already had people that were going to be having parts of their brains removed anyway. These people had tumors in various regions of the brain, and obviously you want to remove those tumors. And so what the researchers did is they looked at 88 people with various types of brain tumors in different parts of the brain, and they gave them a survey to test something called self-transcendence. And this is basically ask respondents, for example, about their tendency to become so absorbed in an activity that they lose track of time and place. And things like, do they feel a strong spiritual connection with other people or with nature? So really trying to get at this whole idea of how religion or something like spirituality would manifest itself in the brain. So they gave these surveys to these people before and after surgery. And what they found is that when people had brain regions removed from various parts of the brain, whether it was the front of the brain or other parts of the brain, the survey answers didn't change that much, but they did change a lot when people had these tumors removed or parts of the brain removed from this posterior parietal brain region.
How did their answers change?
Well, when they had these regions removed, they were much more likely in these surveys to show increases in this self-transcendence quality. In other words, that they were showing more of this sort of religious or spiritual type thinking after the surgery than they had before the surgery.
That's it?
Well, that is. And that's actually one of the critiques an expert had of the study, is that he wished that the authors had really asked more probing questions to these people. Things about like what their religious practices were, maybe how these practices change, or any mystical experiences they had post-surgery that they didn't have pre-surgery. So we've got now a sort of a vague idea that if there is a God spot in the brain, it seems to be in this region. But researchers still aren't clear exactly what this means in terms of the real religion or spiritual experiences that a lot of people have every day.
Well, what's this brain region responsible for in the first place?
Well, researchers already know that the posterior parietal brain region provides awareness of the body's position and location in space. So it's possible that by removing this, we sort of potentially removing ourselves from reality in a sense, and this may help us become more spiritual. Though, again, that's all speculation at this point.
Okay, so what other stories do you have with you this week?
Well, Rob, sticking on the subject of the brain and behavior, this next story is about autism. And as you might know, Rob, people with autism tend to have a hard time in social situations, especially depending on how severe the autism is. They really don't trust people. They don't look people in the eye. They have a hard time socially interacting and even communicating with people. And the story is about, is there any way to potentially correct autism? Because autistics seem to have this sort of fundamental lack of trust, at least trust in social situations. And there's a hormone out there called oxytocin, which researchers have labeled the trust hormone. And the question is, if we give autistics this hormone, can we help curb some of the symptoms of autism?
So using the hormone as a drug, a therapy.
Exactly. And Robin, in other animals, oxytocin functions as a sort of social glue. It, for example, when mice groom and when they mate, they tend to release oxytocin. And even if you give a quote-unquote normal person oxytocin, they tend to be a lot more trustworthy. So, for example, if I gave you a big dose of oxytocin, you would be more likely to lend a stranger money, even if you didn't think that stranger was going to give you anything in return. Again, getting back to this whole idea that this hormone is somehow related to our conceptions of trust and social interactions.
Is the idea then that this would be a continuing treatment throughout the life of the autistic person?
Well, that's a possibility. In this particular study, what they did was they only gave the hormone in sort of short doses. And what they did was they recruited 13 adults with Asperger's syndrome, which is a mild form of autism. And they had them play this computer game of Toss, where they saw various squares on a computer screen. You can actually see a picture of this on the site. And they basically, you know, by playing this computer game, they could quote unquote toss a ball to certain players. And some of these players were friendly players. In other words, when they got the ball tossed to them, they would toss the ball to other players. And some of these players were bullies. In other words, they would just sort of keep the ball to themselves. And what autistics normally do, or what people with Asperger's did in this study, was that they didn't really discriminate between playing with the bully and playing with the person that was friendly. You and I might discriminate because we would say, hey, we're not going to give the ball to the bully anymore. He or she is not sharing it with anybody. But autistics tend not to do that. They don't seem to have the same social concepts of fairness and empathy that other people have. But when the researchers gave these people with Asperger's syndrome a dose of oxytocin, and they did this via a nasal injection, a nasal spray, all of a sudden the autistics stopped playing with the bullies, and they tended to play a lot more with the fair players. And the researchers also ran a second set of experiments where they had the volunteers look at a series of faces. And autistics, when they're given a face to look at, tend to focus on the chin and the mouth, and they rapidly shift their gaze. They're sort of agitated because they don't really seem comfortable looking at faces. But when the researchers gave these people with Asperger's syndrome a dose of oxytocin, all of a sudden they started looking more at the eyes in these faces, again showing that they were feeling more socially comfortable than they had before they had gotten the boost of oxytocin. And another reason the researchers homed in on oxytocin in the first place is because it's been shown in previous studies that autistics tend to have lower levels of oxytocin circulating in their blood. So the idea would be, if we could somehow bring these levels up to normal, maybe we could help autistics behave a little bit more like quote-unquote normal people do. And that's somewhat what they're seeing in this study. This is, you know, very preliminary research, and it's only a small handful of patients. And as you mentioned earlier, Rob, these are short doses over short time periods. It's unclear whether, you know, oxytocin given over the long term would have an effect. But what the researchers are excited about is that a lot of the attempts right now to curb the symptoms of autism happen when people are very young. It's thought that if you address this issue in childhood, then you can help prevent people becoming severe autistics when they're adults. And so the idea would be, if we could give children oxytocin when they're young for long periods of time, that may be another powerful way to help curb the symptoms of this disorder.
Do researchers know if the body builds up some sort of immunity to this hormone therapy, that it would become less effective over time?
Well, that's a good question. I think that sounds like that's an area for further study, is if oxytocin's given over a longer time period, will it still have the same effects, or will the effects diminish over time? But again, you know, this research is all fairly preliminary at this point.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from human behaviors, let's move on to an elephant behavior, or maybe an elephant activity. This last story is about whether elephants actually run.
I suppose this is a matter of definition. What is a run versus a walk?
Well, it's a good question, and that's what this story is all about. When most animals run, they enter a phase where they're basically picking all 4 feet up off the ground. They're moving so fast that they're essentially bounding over the ground. But elephants don't do this. Even if you've seen a charging elephant, you say, that elephant is definitely running. The elephant never takes all 4 feet off the ground. And that's because they're so heavy that they need to distribute their weight well over all their limbs. And they can't do that if they're taking all those limbs off the ground. So based on that alone, you would say, well, I guess elephants don't run because they don't fit that classic definition of what running is. But it turns out there's more to running than just lifting all of your feet off the ground. There's other subtle things like the way you flex your legs and the forces you exert on the ground, and even how your center of gravity changes while you're moving. And researchers have been able to measure this in other animals, including humans. They've had them run on force-sensing plates. But just try getting a 4,000-kilogram elephant to do that. Not so easy.
And terribly expensive, probably.
And too. Very expensive. But actually, in this new study, researchers did it. They made these very large plates, and they constructed a track for elephants, and they had them run on this track. And you actually see a short little video of this on the site. And what they found was that the answer to the question of whether elephants actually run is kind of a maybe. It turns out that elephants do exert some forces that are consistent with running. Their center of gravity moves in a way that's not as much as it does when humans run, but it does change. And also the forces they exert with their front legs are reminiscent of what we would consider running. Although their back legs, the forces they're exerting with their back legs are much more like forces that would be associated with walking. So the easiest way to say it is, do elephants walk or run? Yes, their front legs run, but their back legs walk. They're sort of doing something in between.
So their front legs come off the ground? They're kind of popping a wheelie, as it were?
Well, it's all about the forces. It's not about whether these legs are actually lifting off the ground or not. It's the way the legs are flexing and the forces that they're exerting on the ground that really seem to be consistent, at least with the front legs, with running.
Why have researchers been interested in investigating this problem?
That is a great question, Rob, and one I don't really have an answer to. It's, you know, it's one of those cool animal stories where you go, it's been a mystery for many years, you know, and something that's kind of fun about this story is it seems like it's be something so easy to solve. Do elephants run? Well, yeah, I can look at a movie of an elephant moving very fast and conclude it's running, but this study says otherwise, so science continues to surprise us.
Indeed it does, Dave. Thanks.
Thank you, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the Policy Blog or upcoming at the AAAS annual meeting in San Diego later this week?
Well, Rob, you've given me a lot to deal with. First on Science Now, we've got stories about the mathematics behind Darwin's finches, how there is a very interesting algebraic correlation between the various beak sizes and shapes that Darwin observed during his time on the Galapagos. And also a story about supernovae and dark energy. And on the Policy Blog, Science Insider, we've got a real in-depth look at some of the controversy that's been plaguing the IPCC. This is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Been dogged by a lot of criticism recently about everything from hacked emails to glaciers maybe not melting as fast or moving as fast as they claimed. And so we've got an analysis of a lot of the criticisms that have been leveled against IPCC over the past few weeks and whether any of these criticisms actually hold water, as it were. And Rob, you mentioned the AAAS meeting. We're going to be there covering it live starting Thursday. You can check out all of our coverage. It's going to be on the main Science Now site, which, by the way, is a brand new site. And we've got a new URL, too. It's news.sciencemag.org. The old URL will also take you there. But we've got a brand new site. We're going to be posting items throughout the day, even when the AAAS meeting is over. Lots of cool multimedia, including the stuff that you'll be doing from the meeting, Rob. All the great podcast work that you do.
Thank you.
So be sure to check out all of this stuff, all of this great stuff on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the Science Policy Blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the February 19th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, the Science Society, thanks for joining us.